Everyone, thank you for tuning into the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. It's October 2018, and you're listening to episode 92 of Postmodern Realities, and I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. On this episode, I'm joined by Stephen Mitchell. Stephen teaches English and chairs the Department of Humanities at Covenant Day School in North Carolina, and he holds a PhD in humanities. In the 2018 Volume 41, Number 5 issue of the Christian Research Journal, Stephen has written a feature article about the novelist, the writer, Flannery O'Connor, called Flannery O'Connor and the Problem of Freedom. Stephen, it's good to have you on.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, please tell our listeners who was the writer Flannery O'Connor. She's no longer alive. And why is her work important?
Sure. So Flannery O'Connor is a mid-20th century novelist, primarily novelist, short story writer. She also wrote some nonfiction essays. Very highly regarded in her day, and then after her rather early death from lupus, her work took on even more prominence. She was known for her staunch Catholic faith, and for the way that that faith helped to influence and shape her work, work that, despite its being so deeply informed by her Catholic vision, was still, and I think she would think, not despite, but because of that, appealing far beyond Catholic writers to the general populace and to secular readers as well. Although in her time, she did have to fight against some misunderstanding of her work, and we'll get into that a little bit later in the podcast. But I think Flannery O'Connor would herself say that if her work's important, first and foremost, this is central to her self-understanding and to her understanding of novels and short stories. It's because they're good. In O'Connor's artistic vision, you really had one sort of bedrock reason to justify being a writer, and that is that you were good at it. And this is rooted in her idea that art's first responsibility is to be good art. In other words, it's theological and it's philosophical and it's moral and thematic dimensions they work in, but fundamentally, you're making something. An analogy would be that, a chair maker's first responsibility is to make a good chair. And that there just are elements of good art that have to be there. And if they're not there, it doesn't matter how astute you are theologically. It doesn't matter how astute you are philosophically or how much of a moralist you are. If you can't write good stories, you need to stop. And one of the things that's just wonderful about her work is that, odd as it is, it's just very, 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 very good. And her capacity to render believable extremists and through that to speak something important about the world. So that's, I think, what makes her important.
So besides her Catholic faith, obviously that shaped her view of the world. And you were just mentioning her view of art. How did it shape how she thought about herself?
Yeah. Well, she saw herself as having a vocation, and this word figures prominently in her work, and I think even influences even the content of her stories. And O'Connor understood vocation in the old religious sense, not in the more reduced sense we tend to use it today, which is just your job, but in this idea of a calling. So she had a vocation to be a novelist. And she says of herself, actually, at one point writing to, I believe it was Cecil Dawkins, a correspondent of hers, that vocation implies limitation. And so she had a responsibility, she felt, to write. And also she had a responsibility to write, as she would say, the kind of stories I can make believable. So given that she's a Catholic writer, she sees herself as being, first of all, created, and created as a particular kind of being with particular gifts, and that being true to that, to what she is able to do, was part of being a true artist, a part of being a true Catholic, part of being true to her humanity. And so vocation is this really important element of O'Connor's own self-understanding, as well as the way she understands, especially many of the characters in her larger novels.
So Flannery O'Connor is really known for her use of just outlandish and grotesque, very exaggerated characters. So what makes her characters grotesque? Why does she exaggerate them that way? And why does she find such characters congenial to her work as a novelist?
Yeah. So the grotesque characters of Flannery O'Connor, this is a thing for which she was famous. It is also the basis on which originally, a lot of the criticism of her work, was based that there was something wrong with her artwork because she drew such grotesque characters. And so she spent a lot of time defending this, and she had she's very specific reasons for it. Again, it's important to remember that she is not only Catholic, but specifically Thomistic in her view of art. So drawing off the aesthetics of St. Thomas Aquinas, especially as sort of interpreted through the work of Jacques Maritain, the French neo-Thomist, who is something of a contemporary of hers. And this meant that, going back to that idea of the artist's first responsibility being to make a good piece of art, this idea of the grotesqueness of a character has to do with what it is that that you can see and that you can make believable to your audience. So O'Connor knew that she was exaggerating the characters of her stories. So to take, for example, Hazel Motes, who we'll be talking about in more in depth later, who is this backwoods preacher, but sort of an anti-preacher, in that the book story opens really with his determination to prove that he doesn't believe in Jesus. And so he becomes this kind of mimetic parody of a kind of backwoods Protestant itinerant revivalist preacher. But instead of preaching for faith in Jesus Christ, he's preaching against faith in Jesus Christ. And O'Connor said that one of her primary reasons for doing this was she had to make a character believable in being obsessed with salvation and redemption, even if that means rejecting it. To make him believable to an audience who had primarily, in her estimation, and she's talking about the wider readership of the English-speaking world, had primarily passed out of faith, and so really couldn't take very seriously the claims of the religious faith or of a religious faith, and she felt that these grotesque characters could be believable in part because of their grotesqueness. Another reason that she said this, though, was that she's famous for saying at one point that to a world that is blind, you draw very, very large characters. And for a person who is deaf, and I'm paraphrasing her, you scream. And her sense was that she was writing for an audience who had largely become spiritually deaf. And the grotesqueness of these characters, their extremeness, could have this ability to kind of wake readers to the possibilities of divine realities being at work in the concrete, everyday world of human beings. She really felt that she was balancing, if you will, another form of grotesqueness, which most of her readers would not recognize as grotesque, and that would be really the average everyday person who lives as if the world of the spirit has no real bearing on his life, who lives as a kind of functional materialist. She says, this is another form of grotesqueness. And my characters, in their extremism, challenge a grotesqueness that I think my audience thinks is normal. So they're congenial to her work in that way.
So what are some of the more important themes in Flannery O'Connor's work?
Sure. So I would point to probably two or three that I find especially important. One of those is this idea of whether or not I am in fact spiritually whole. A character is. Like, is there something missing in me? Or am I, in fact, more or less okay the way I am? And you can see this from something as simple and wonderful as her short story, Revelation, which has the the wonderful character of Miss Ruby Turpin, who is this self-satisfied, middle-class, southern country woman who undergoes this really disturbing awakening to her own kind of self-righteous pride and to the spiritual value of these other people whom she has seen as being beneath her in the social hierarchy, and having to face the fact that while they may be in terms of manners, in terms of their social development, in terms of their education, they may be in the social hierarchy less than her, they are, in fact, very likely spiritually far in advance of her, because she has to come to grips with the fact, through being violently confronted with her own smugness, that she is not, in fact, as good as she thinks she is. You see this in a short story in which a young boy actually drowns himself, a five-year-old boy, looking for the kingdom of God, because he unfortunately takes too literally the words of baptism, but which nonetheless signifies the kind of emptiness of the life that he had known with parents who ignored the spiritual realm. So this idea is human life or a human character complete, or do they need to face their incompleteness? The second important theme that I think I see in her work and that really fascinates me and that I'm actually writing about, of course, is this idea of what is a free human being? Like, what constitutes human freedom? And this is less a political question, though it is that for her, than it is a kind of ontological question, a religious question. Who gets to determine what reality is? And who gets to determine what kind of being I am? Do I wholly hold that? Or is there, in fact, a divine being who, being responsible for my existence, has, in fact, given it a particular shape and structure that I have to really submit to? So I would say those are the two themes that I probably see and value most prominently in her work.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Stephen Mitchell, and in the 2018 Volume 41, Number 5 issue of the Christian Research Journal, Stephen has written a feature article called Flannery O'Connor and the Problem of Freedom. Also in this issue, you will not want to miss out on reading articles about solo sex and the Christian, ghost hunters, and the Me Too movement and forgiveness in the church. So to read these articles, please subscribe to the journal. A 6-issue subscription is now at a new lower price of $33.50. And to subscribe online, go to our website, equip.org. We're just talking about some of the themes in her work, and you were talking about human freedom. And what makes Flannery O'Connor's understanding of human freedom important for the contemporary conversation, important to the Christian apologist today, especially as it relates to freedom, human agency, and, you know, human nature?
Well, as it can probably put as simply as this, are there limits to human freedom or aren't there? Now, practically speaking, most people would say, well, yes, there have to be, just because there are other human beings around. But her question is quite a bit deeper than that. And that is, do I have a nature that is a particular thing and that cannot be violated, even if I want to violate it? without doing violence to who and what I am, without hurting me. In other words, is the desires that I find within myself, my will, is it indeed the supreme determiner of reality? Or is reality in its physical, spiritual, and moral manifestations, does it precede my will? And is it a thing to which, to be truly free, I actually have to submit? You know, Augustine, and again, I'm paraphrasing him, but he said essentially, freedom is submitting to the law of God, or freedom is submitting to, which also would be freedom would be submitting to the law of our nature. And since O'Connor was so orthodox a Catholic, you know, she accepted natural law theory with her other Thomistic ethics and things. And so she felt that when we lived contrary to a human nature that was received in our being as creatures, when we live contrary to that, we enslave ourselves, even if we want to live contrary to it. So our human desires are worth questioning and interrogating. Wanting a thing and going after it do not automatically make us free. They might, in fact, enslave us. And so, as it seems to me that the contemporary vision of human freedom is pushing more and more and more out to this idea that we make ourselves, we create ourselves. In fact, we declare ourselves to be whatever it is we decide we want to be. I think that Flannery O'Connor's work pushes back against that. And she suggests very, very forcefully that we don't make ourselves. We don't make ourselves morally. We don't make ourselves physically. We don't make ourselves spiritually. And so there is a law, which is just the structure of existence, that true freedom accepts. And that, I think, is what makes her particularly relevant, her work particularly relevant to the contemporary conversation about freedom.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, for probably non-English majors, and I was an English major, Flannery O'Connor is probably best known for the short stories that she wrote, but she also wrote novels, and one of them is called Wise Blood, and you talk about that in the article. And in that novel, the main character, Hazel Motes, who you mentioned earlier, he's the grandson of a preacher, and he no longer believes in God as the novel opens, and he's returning home to Tennessee after World War II. And you had said a little bit ago that he has a fear of Jesus, even though he no longer believes in God. So what causes the deep fear of Jesus that's haunting this character, Hazel Motes?
Yes. So O'Connor is probably more widely known for her stories, but it's really, you're doing yourself an injustice as far as her work goes, not to know her novels. She wrote two of them, Wise Blood and The Violent Buried Away, and they are just exceptional, exceptionally crafted and exceptionally perceptive. And in this one, Wise Blood, there's this character, Hazel Motes, who is, again, the grotesqueness of her novels is also comic. So these are just funny. Her work is often darkly funny, but funny. And Hazel Motes insists that he doesn't believe in Jesus. But, you know, from the old Hamlet, or the Shakespearean Hamlet play, The Lady Doth Protest Too Much, Methinks, is the thing that comes to mind when you read him. Because from the beginning, he's telling everybody how little he believes in Jesus. People who aren't asking, people who don't care, people who don't want to have anything to do with a spiritual conversation at all. So the real, so part of the real comedy with Hazel Motes is that despite his insistence to the contrary and his attempt to prove to others and to himself that he doesn't believe in Jesus, he kind of does. But he fears him because he sees Jesus as a limitation upon his will. Now, part of that comes from his grandfather's very fierce version of Christianity, which describes Jesus as this kind of stalker or hunter that's after his soul. It describes him as soul hungry. But what Hayes really doesn't want is anybody to determine for him what is good and what is not, what he ought to do, what he ought not do, the meaning of his life. And he knows deep, deep inside of him that if Jesus is in fact divine, if there is a God, then Hayes's will is not supreme. And that's why he fears Jesus, because it means the submission of his will to a higher being. And the loss in his mind, he's got this vision of freedom, the loss in his mind of his freedom, because for him, freedom means doing whatever he wants, in whatever situation he wants, whenever he wants.
So in this novel, Wise Blood, that we're talking about, O'Connor makes sexual desire actually one locus of conflict in her treatment of freedom. So what makes human sexuality important to her treatment of human freedom, you know, via this character of Hazel Motes?
Yeah, so I think this is one of the more perceptive elements of this novel, that O'Connor really understood the complicated nature of human desire. So Hayes, early in his life, has this voyeuristic experience at a carnival where he sees it's a pornographic experience where he sees this nude woman doing some lascivious things, and he gets punished for it, and he goes through all these mechanisms of repentance. But the real reason is to satisfy Jesus and keep Jesus at a distance. This is when he's a child and hasn't yet decided he doesn't believe in Jesus. But as he grows up, he decides, and O'Connor lays this out very clearly through the narrator in the book, that the way to avoid Jesus was to avoid sin. So Hayes decides he's not going to get caught up in any sort of sexual sin, especially while he's in the army, because if he does, Jesus might be out to get him. You know, by get him, he means redeem him too, not necessarily punish him. But then he's told he doesn't have a soul. But he meets some friends that tell him this, and this means, well, if I don't, then Jesus can't possibly want to redeem me, and I can do what I want. So he decides when he gets back to seek out a prostitute and begin a relationship with her, but specifically not because she offered him pleasure, but because to sleep with a prostitute proves I don't believe in sin. So it's this willful, this liaison with the sexual liaison based in the will. The problem, though, comes is that once he's with her, despite how retrograde she is, and it's kind of funny how disgusting of a character she's physically shown to be, but she arouses his desire. And so the problem here becomes, Motes' problem becomes really subtle in that he wants his will to be supreme. But not only does Jesus threaten that, but as it turns out, so does his own sexual desire, because that is seemingly not within the control of his will. He wants to have a sexual relationship with a prostitute to prove that he doesn't believe in Jesus. But once he begins it, he finds that his body responds contrary to his will. And so one thing that O'Connor is pushing Hayes to recognize is that the human will does not, in fact, have complete dominance, even in something so simple as sexual desire. That there are forces at work shaping him, whether he likes it or not. And they aren't just divine in the terms of a redeemer, but they are also in the very structure of his being. And he runs into this several other times where he experiences the sexual interest of women in him as a kind of threat to his freedom as well. And he, on one hand, wants to engage because, of course, he's a normal human being. On the other hand, he fears it because the desire for women in some way reminds him of the interest of Jesus in him. And so this idea that I can be completely free of anything alluring me or shaping my existence aside from my will, that fear goes deep in Hazel Motes and affects his relationships with these women as well.
So in the article, you are also talking about how Hazel Motes is battling reality, and you note that he has a car that's part of that battle. So why does Flannery O'Connor specifically choose a car as a symbol for his demand for freedom?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons for this. One is that the car kind of shows baldly that a rank materialism has become Hayes's response to the possibility of the divine. I want to deny the divine. I want to deny the possibility of my redemption. And I want to take refuge in the fact that the world is material and only material. And so the question then becomes, can a car in fact be a source of freedom? He takes it as a source of freedom. He calls it a place that I can be, that I can always get away in. So when a woman, for example, is making too much of a claim upon me, I can get in a car and get away. If a man does, presumably if God does, I can escape. That's his thought. The car is a way of escape. It can't make a claim upon me, and I can kind of hide from all of these other claims upon my will and my freedom that others may make. But it goes a step farther. Hazel Motes' car, and this is, again, part of the comedy of the story, is just a piece of junk. He buys it from a junkyard or a used car lot that is almost a junkyard. It barely runs. It's got a 2x4 for the back seat. One of the doors is tied on. The engine is utterly debased mechanically. But Hayes calls it repeatedly, it's a good car, it's a good car, it's a good car. And nobody who has a good car needs to be redeemed, he said. So you have this, there's this puzzlement. Why would Hayes buy such a dilapidated car? And why insist to the contrary to what is obviously true, that the car is good? Well, Hayes is simultaneously making another assertion repeatedly, and that is, in his words, I am clean. And he's, of course, referring to his the state of his soul. I am clean. I am clean. I am clean. So the car is good and he is clean. These are two proclamations that Hayes makes about, one about the material world and one about himself. And there's nothing else grounding these claims but his own word. And so what we see here is that Hayes wants, through his own power and his own will, to determine the nature of reality. Both the quality of the car, which he refuses until the car is actually broken into a bunch of pieces later in the novel, he refuses to accept that it's a really terrible car, and he refuses to accept that he is sinful and wants his own word, his own desire, his own will to determine the physical good of the car and the moral good of his soul. And the comedy is, of course, he can't do this. Like, you can only declare a car good for so long. And when the thing finally falls apart, you just are left with recognizing that there's a limit to your power to make the world what you want it to be. And so that's where the car shows his battle with reality.
Well, I want everyone to subscribe to the journal, because Stephen also unpacks things and themes in her probably better known novel, The Violent Buried Away. And so you'll want to make sure that you subscribe to the journal so that you can read his article. So finally, I want to end with some fun rapid fire questions for Stephen. Well, it's fall now, so pumpkin pie or pumpkin spice latte?
Oh, definitely pumpkin pie.
Are you an introvert or extrovert?
I am deeply introverted. Deeply.
Calling or texting, which do you prefer?
Depends on the situation. As an introvert, a texting lets you deal with people kind of at a distance, which is perhaps not always the best way to deal with them, but sometimes it's comfortable.
That's true. And early bird or night owl?
Something of a night owl, actually, which didn't used to be the case, but in the last five to eight years has come to be.
Well, Stephen, thanks for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you, Melanie. It was my pleasure.
Today's guest is Stephen Mitchell, and in the 2018 Volume 41, Number 5 issue of the Christian Research Journal, Stephen has written a feature article called Flannery O'Connor and the Problem of Freedom. To read his article, please subscribe to the journal. A 6-issue subscription is now at a new lower price of $33.50, and to subscribe online, please go to our website, equip.org. We'd like to hear from you, so connect with us on social media. like the Bible Answer Man Facebook page, and follow CRI, Christian Research Journal, Hank Hanegraaff, and the Bible Answer Man on Twitter. Follow the Bible Answer Man on Instagram, and please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man channel on YouTube. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Postmodern Realities podcast on iTunes. And when you rate and review our podcast, it helps others to find our content. So please share this episode on your social media accounts. Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 888-ASK-HANK Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. In addition, head to iTunes and subscribe to Hank Unplugged. It's Hank's new audio podcast. You'll follow Hank off the grid, where he has in-depth conversations with some of the brightest minds discussing topics you care about. So until our next Christian Research Journal author conversation, thanks for listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast.